once the oil hits the water, the plan is all but its words on a page.
Alaskans offer lessons to be learned from the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 8th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, finding talent statewide for a Hollywood movie.
Everything from 14-year-old girls that just know they could be a movie star to just very wise Native elders.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The U.S. Coast Guard has released the names of the Sitka crew members aboard a helicopter that went down in the waters off LaPush, Washington yesterday. The survivor of the crash is 29-year-old Lieutenant Lance Leone. He's recovering from non-life-threatening injuries at a Seattle hospital. Killed in Wednesday's accident were Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Lieutenant Sean Kruger was from Seymour, Connecticut, and was the commander of the helicopter. He was 33 years old and married with three children. Inside the hangar at Coast Guard Air Station Sitka, Lieutenant Nate Hudson is standing with a group of friends. Hudson is a pilot, and he's known Kruger for the last 10 years. He says they worked together at Air Station Cape Cod before Kruger went on an exchange tour with the British Royal Navy's Search and Rescue Detachment for about 3 years.
And when I checked into Air Station Cape Cod, we decided to live into housing. And we got into the housing office and somebody said, hey, we've already got a house reserved for you. And I went and it was right across the street from the Krugers. That was just kind of the kind of people that they are.
Kruger had been stationed in Sitka for about a year and a half. And Hudson says he was active in the community.
He was not only a soccer coach, but he's a ref. He refed football and soccer and very well known in the school districts and all ages of sporting activities.
Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, age 40, was from Great Falls, Montana. He was an aviation maintenance technician and has one son.
I've been stationed with Adam about 15 years of my career.
That's Petty Officer First Class Matthew McGee, who met Adam Hoke in flight and mechanic school.
He loved the Coast Guard. He had a lot of dedication to what he did here, and that was it seems like that was his every waking moment is what can I do better for the Coast Guard.
Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks, age 33, was from Rock Spring, Wyoming. He was an aircraft maintenance technician and has a wife and two children.
He was my go-to guy.
That's Petty Officer First Class Troy Brevik, who worked with Banks for 9 years.
When we needed something done, you know, he was, you know, especially metalsmithing, he could certainly bend some metal and make something happen, whether it was on the aircraft or making an adjustment for his boat, you know, coming up with ideas, you know, together on our boats. What can we do to make things work better and more efficiently?
Brevik says the two were stationed together in Kodiak and Sitka, and they spent a lot of time together off duty.
Usually when we go out hunting and stuff, we would certainly take our time coming back so we could, and not only enjoy the sights, but always hope for that one last glimpse of, you know, putting some food on the table.
Banks also was an active member of Sitka Mountain Rescue. The three who died, along with Lieutenant Lance Leone, who survived, were all decorated Coast Guardsmen with numerous medals and accolades on their records. Commander Doug Cameron has been the commanding officer at Air Station Sitka for about a week and a half. He's been holding regular meetings with the approximately 120 people who work at the station.
When I look at all their faces, I see the whole spectrum, you know, from the shock, disbelief to like anger, why did this happen, to the just plain sadness at the loss. And so it's a very individual thing.
Coast Guard personnel from Cordova have been brought in to perform the normal operations in Sitka for a week or so. The Coast Guard also ordered all air stations nationwide to break from normal operations and review safety practices. With help from KCAW's Lily Mihalik, I'm Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
Last night, a trickle of highly motivated Alaskans brought their ideas to Presidential Oil Spill Commission member Fran Ulmer at the first of a series of listening sessions at the University of Alaska. Many of those commenting had experience stretching back to the Exxon Valdez spill, and they said it appears that the nation has yet to learn all the lessons from that spill, even though more than 20 years have passed. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
They're up here watching the media coverage of the Gulf of Mexico spill, and a lot of them are getting frustrated and want to do more. A man drove up from Clam Gulch when he heard about the listening session on the radio to offer a spill response vehicle they'd built. A student in the University of Alaska Social Work School said she'd donated her hair for making spill booms, and several just stepped up to say they didn't think they were getting the straight story. Betty Miller has been an outreach worker in Prince William Sound for BP and the other companies that own the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It looks to her as if BP has grown out of touch.
They didn't understand the importance of community relations and talking to the people in the communities. They've gone so far away from that that it's not important to them anymore. And it really is important because those are the voices that are going to come back and say, "Where were you when we needed to talk to you?"
Miller said she wasn't sure what the commission could do or recommend to address that lack of communication. Others had very specific recommendations. Toxicologist John French, who serves on one of the watchdog groups set up after the Exxon Valdez spill, said a similar body will be needed in the Gulf of Mexico to sound the alarm about regulatory erosion. French said he was afraid that even in Alaska, if a spill like the Exxon Valdez happened again, we would once again find ourselves without the capacity to pick up that much oil. Speaking by teleconference from the university campus in Seward, French said there will be impacts from this new spill that will have to be measured over time.
You know, we're still seeing 2 decades after the Exxon Valdez unexpected adverse effects on the environment. And we need to expect that those will occur in the Gulf of Mexico spill, too. We've done not only extensive use, the largest amount of chemical dispersion ever used, we've also used it at depths where it's never been even tried before. And we have no idea. And even EPA admits we have no idea what the environmental consequences are.
Dave Harbour, a former regulator and industry blogger, warned Ulmer of the danger of overreacting.
Making recommendations in the next 6 months that lead to years of unnecessary regulation and delay, and I say if it would lead to unnecessary regulation, could be an improper reaction to the tragic events now unfolding and further cripple our economy as it seeks recovery.
Longtime industry spill response executive Jeff Merrill called the Oil Pollution Act passed after the Alaska spill an emotional reaction and bad public policy that took the industry years to figure out. He said regulations can unintentionally tie the hands of responders.
Once the oil hits the water, the plan is all but its words on a page. So as you consider whatever findings your commission will bring forward, do what you can. Enable the responder to do his job, his or her job, as effectively as he or she can without being handcuffed by either regulation or fiat or guideline or whatever other stricture might be put in place.
Tom Lockish of Anchorage, who fought and won a court battle over his right to personally respond to the Exxon Valdez spill, defended the current law. He said the problem is its implementation. The law says a spill should be cleaned up, but the Coast Guard has never insisted that the industry invest in the best available spill response technology, even though that's exactly what the law spells out. Lockish says without the prod of regulatory requirements, the industry's remaining incentive is financial.
There is no incentive for these guys to actually plan to do the job that the response plans say. Regulators use a totally divorced methodology. They all consider it nothing but paper. When it's our livelihoods and our environment at stake.
Ulmer intends to have more listening sessions. She listened to the comments of Alaskans without making any response, saying only that it would be premature to react before the commission has started its business. There is no date yet set for the first meeting of the 7-member commission. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, at the tail end of the Denali climbing season, officials perform an unusual rescue on the mountain. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Legislators today encourage South Central residents to have a say in their future energy needs. Seven members of the State House and Senate said ConocoPhillips needs to assure a local supply of natural gas for the region before getting an extension of its export license. ConocoPhillips and Marathon Oil have applied for a new permit to extend the time allowed to ship 98 billion cubic feet of gas under a permit granted in 2008. About 40 billion cubic feet remain. While not opposing the export permit, pointing to its value to the state and region, Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski said Alaska needs to make certain it takes care of its own before shipping more gas to Japan.
Without more gas, ENSTAR could be forced to terminate services of some of its customers. ENSTAR has been trying to secure gas contracts for the next 3 years. They, however, have not been fully successful. Requests for bids have been sent out. Requests were sent to ConocoPhillips. ConocoPhillips declined on multiple occasions to sell gas to ENSTAR.
ENSTAR is Anchorage's local natural gas utility. Under federal law, local needs must be met before export is allowed, and Willikowski predicts that after shortages in 2011 and 12, more than a third of the region's needs will be unmet in 2013. Natalie Lohman with ConocoPhillips says as long as the LNG plant is in operation, the company will continue to meet local needs.
Last year, we signed a 7-year gas supply contract with Chugach Electric, and we have an existing contract with ENSTAR. So we are continuing to deliver on our commitments and are working with ENSTAR now on options to address any additional unmet gas needs.
The application ConocoPhillips has filed with the U.S. Department of Energy says the new permit will not provide more gas for export than was allowed under the current permit. The company also promises to provide a backup supply for local needs. Without the permit, there is a risk the company would cut off year-round production because of market conditions, making the export permit the key to actual expansion of supply and future energy security. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker sponsored the Cook Inlet Recovery Act that was signed into law following this year's session. He says he recognizes the potential supply problem, but says the export license is critical to avoiding a region-wide failure. Hawker says the wells generate excess gas when they're not meeting peak demand.
So what do you do with that excess in those hot summer days? The choice is either to, you know, flare it off in the inlet and waste it, put it into some kind of storage capacity for winter, which we don't have at this time, or export it. So for the last 60 years, the exporting of gas has been the activity that has kept gas both available and affordable in this community.
The U.S. Energy Department will accept public comments on the export permit until August 1st. Two Chinook helicopters from Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks assisted in a medical evacuation on Mount McKinley yesterday. The rescue not only involved climbing rangers and the military, but also Fairbanks area state troopers. From KTNA in Talkeetna, Sue Dio has the story.
A 24-year-old man from Pennsylvania had registered to climb Denali and had made it to the 14,000-foot camp on the mountain before rangers advised the Talkeetna Ranger Station that an evacuation should take place due to emotional instability. South District Ranger John Leonard says he met the man before his climb, and he just seemed like a young man with a bit of a chip on his shoulder, which wasn't necessarily a signal the man should not climb the mountain. The young man had listed Aconcagua, Elbrus, and Kilimanjaro as mountains previously climbed, so he had climbing experience but no glacier travel. However, Maureen McLaughlin, public information officer, says a couple of things became a concern before his flight up to the Kahiltna base camp.
He had mentioned to a few local residents that he intended to paraglide off the summit. So with that information in hand, some of our rangers had confronted him and mentioned that this was an illegal activity in the park and that he could not do so. He did agree to, and they signed an affidavit that he would not, in fact, bring his equipment on the mountain.
She said things went downhill a bit after he got on the glacier.
Once up on the mountain, he was showing definitely an incompetence in glacier travel. Other groups had shown he had some improper human waste disposal, littering, just some odd interactions with some other climbing parties.
Paul Marcolini of Greenwood, Maine, has been volunteering for the Park Service on Denali for 5 years and was one of those that dealt with the situation at 14,000 feet. It became clearer that he wasn't in a stable frame of mind by actions and aggressiveness toward rangers and other climbers.
It did not seem like the 14 and above was a safe place for him to be with his level of experience and the plan that he had in mind. So mixed with some of the things that happened on the lower glacier, as well as still having his kite with him, we, for the most part, suggested that his trip was probably over and he needed to start back down again.
Rangers thought the rescue helicopter might be in order, so he wouldn't be in harm's way descending to base camp. McLaughlin said that rangers began to form another plan as the situation deteriorated.
It was just determined based on some of his more aggressive statements and a little more self-destructive statements that it would not be safe to put him and an attendant in our very compact helicopter that we typically use for that.
The 24-year-old was flown to Fairbanks from Denali via Chinook helicopter and met in Fairbanks by Alaska State Troopers for assistance. He is currently in Fairbanks for evaluation. McLaughlin says the situation, as with any medical evacuation, is now in the hands of medical professionals. There are still over 100 climbers on the mountain. Base camp is disassembled on Monday, and the last ranger patrol comes off the mountain on Wednesday. Reporting in Talkeetna, this is Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
A local film production company is heading to Northwest Alaska tonight to continue auditions for the Hollywood film Everybody Loves Whales. The film stars Drew Barrymore and tells the story of the 1988 attempt to rescue three gray whales trapped in the sea ice near Barrow. 100% of the movie is being shot in the state. Deborah Schilt with Alaska Film Services is working to cast Alaskans in 30 speaking roles. She's traveling the state to find talent and has already been to Barrow. Tonight, she's flying to Kotzebue, and from there, she's heading to Nome. Schilt says she's had no trouble finding people interested in stardom.
When the article first hit the newspaper, we had over 1,000 Gmail responses. So that was a pretty good response. It took us about 3 days to get through that 1,000, and after that, we dropped down to about 200 a day, and I think now we're probably averaging, I don't know, anywhere between 50 and 100 email responses from around the state per day, not just from Anchorage and not just from Alaska. We've actually had contacts from people in Spain that are interested and people that used to live here that would like to come back if they could have a part in the movie. And so I don't know. I think it has been a good response. Yeah. A lot of people out there looking for stardom.
Apparently so. Did you think you would find so many potential actors in Alaska?
Well, I live here, and as does Grace. And we've both been casting here for upwards of 20 years. And so we know Alaska's got talent. So we're not really surprised. We believe in hiring local and finding local talent. And, you know, everyone at one point or another had their first movie, you know. So to discover someone that has that potential is, I think, a very realistic ambition.
Deborah, what kind of talent are you seeing so far across the state?
Everything from 14-year-old girls that just know they could be a movie star to just very wise Native elders that can memorize lines, that have really interesting improvs when they reflect back on their lives in growing up in a small village. A big arc. We see some wannabes that see themselves one way, and in fact, we don't see them that way at all. But there's also a lot of extras that will work on this film. So even if the people that come in don't land a speaking role, there are hundreds and hundreds of extras that we're going to use both here and in Barrow.
Are you hopeful that this movie will spark more Hollywood interest in actually filming up here in Alaska?
Well, I know that it will. We will see not just tourists coming with a new interest in parts of Alaska and subjects in Alaska. We'll see other filmmakers and other producers and other directors with a vision that they maybe hadn't thought about Alaska before, that when they see this film, they'll see our potential. We also have a film incentive program in place now in the state of Alaska. So now that we have incentives, we can really compete in the marketplace, and we're hopeful that in the future, films that are set in Alaska or that feature Alaska won't go to Canada, won't go to Louisiana, won't go to Washington State. Alaskan subject films will get shot in Alaska, and all of Alaska will benefit from that.
Deborah Schilt is casting for the film Everybody Loves Whales. To arrange an audition, send an email to alaskafilmservices@gmail.com. If you live in Nome or Kotzebue, put that in the subject line. The film will be shooting from the middle of September through middle of November. Anchorage's area wildlife biologist has retired. Rick Sinnott started with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in 1982 and has held the Anchorage position for more than 15 years. It's been a challenging job. Anchorage is the biggest city in the world that boasts a metropolitan mix of brown and black bears, moose, and other unusual urban wildlife. It's been Sinnott's job to preserve harmony between all of the city's residents, wild and human. A few years ago, APRN's Annie Feit produced a profile of Sinnott and his unusual work life. In honor of his retirement, we pulled the story from our archives.
Rick Sinnott always knew he was going to spend his life working with wildlife. He just didn't know he was going to get paid for it. Then he found out in an English class that there was such a thing as a wildlife biologist. He remembers it as an exciting moment.
Until then, I thought, well, I'll be a trapper or just someone that lives in the woods and, you know, communes with animals.
Sinnott started out at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in the mid-80s. He says he decided early on that the Anchorage wildlife position was his dream job.
I like the whole aspect of people and wildlife interacting at whatever level both are comfortable with, you know.
Sinnott's desk barely fits in his packed Anchorage office. There are four tall file cabinets, shelves piled with books and maps covering nearly every inch of wall space, and the ceiling, too. An old moose collar serves as a doorstop. He dresses the same in winter and summer, extra tufts and black jeans topped with a faded plaid button-up shirt. In the field, he might as well be wearing a referee's uniform. He says he sees himself that way, smoothing things over between city residents and wildlife.
They're alien beings. People and wildlife don't think alike at all in most cases. So I'm sort of in the middle, and I'm trying to explain the rules to both sides. And sometimes the people get it. The wildlife almost never do. So you're just trying to work out the details and making sure that the game goes on.
Summer is Sinnott's busiest time. There are weeks when he sleeps only 4 hours a night. On a sunny day last August, he waded into Campbell Creek to collect brown bear hair for a research project. As king salmon swam by, he said he wished more residents were willing to see the city from a bear's perspective.
You can imagine how big a bear's eyes will get when they see a fish that weighs like 30 pounds. It's like, that's enough to, you know, take a little bit of the hunger pangs off of a bear.
In general, Sinnott says he's amazed at how tolerant city dwellers are of the bears. But he says during his 2 decades on the job, he's heard plenty of wacky ideas for handling the city's wildlife. One idea that's popped up a few times is to build a giant chain-link fence around the city, topped with barbed wire.
And then you either move all the animals from the city to the other side of the fence, to the park, or you somehow, I don't know how you get them out, shoot them or something, which is just the most cracked idea that I can think about. I mean, from some all kinds of levels. We've got the Seward Highway and the Glen Highway that come into town, and the animals will be lined up on those highways trying to get back in the fence because this is their winter habitat. You know, they got to be here. at least for moose, it's the opposite. It's their summer habitat for bears.
You would think constantly interacting with bears and moose would be dangerous, but Sinnott has only rarely been injured on the job. His biggest scare recently came in his car, on his time off. At the end of September, he was driving along Diamond Boulevard with his wife at 11 p.m. He was heading home from a celebration for his 56th birthday. He pulled up to a stoplight on King Street and heard a series of gunshots.
I thought I felt something hit the car and me, but what I noticed most was that the car windows next to us, left of us, both got blown out. Both the driver's and the passenger side windows looked like were just blown, just shattered. So I fell over my wife and said, I think I've been hit, and kind of felt my leg and felt some blood.
Sinnott had been shot in his upper thigh. Doctors decided to leave the bullet where it landed, and he jokes now that his left leg is slightly heavier than his right.
And I also ask about, getting through airport security and stuff like that with a bullet in my leg, and the doctor said, well, you know, that's not going to be a problem. The machines aren't that sensitive. And then she thought for a second, and she said, well, unless we're in code orange or red, and then it might set off some alarms. I don't know. I don't fly very much, so I haven't had a chance to test it yet.
Looking ahead, Sinnott doesn't see himself staying in his demanding job too much longer. He says he's looking forward to spending more time writing poetry. He's racked up a number of wins in the annual haiku contest in the Anchorage Press. Last year, he placed first in two categories, including Death of the Fur Rondi.
Call it the Fur Bowl, move it to L.A., and we'll watch it on TV.
He says his best haikus come to him on his drive to work in one brilliant flash.
You know, some people say that I'm a better writer than I, or a poet than I am a biologist, which I don't know, may be true. Someone pointed out that I've won awards writing haikus, but I haven't won any awards yet as a wildlife biologist. So I don't know, maybe there's some truth to that.
Sinnott says he doesn't spend enough time writing poetry to call it a passion yet, but maybe retirement will change that. I'm Annie Feit.
That story was from the APRN archives. Rick Sinnott retired as the Anchorage area biologist at the end of June. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco and Sitka, Sue Dio and Tel Keatna, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.